Talkers.
Welcome to Speak and Destroy, episode 19. Speak and Destroy is a podcast about all things Metallica. I am your host, Ryan J. Downey. My guest this episode is Nick Calmer, better known as Animal, lead singer for legendary hardcore punk band Anti-Nowhere League. A year after their formation, Anti-Nowhere League found themselves in the top 50 on the UK singles chart with their 1981 piss take of English folk singer Ralph McTell's Streets of London. The B-side of that single was even more fantastically audacious and ridiculous. Thanks to the outrageous lyrical content of So What, the Metropolitan Police's obscene publication squad seized copies of the Anti-Nowhere League single from the distributor. The band played shows with fellow influential groups like The Damned, The Exploited, and The Meteors, until real-life responsibilities and the reality of the financial side of a small punk band ended Anti-Nowhere League in 1987. Fast forward to 1992. Metallica invites Animal on stage with them at Wembley Arena. The renewed interest in Anti-Nowhere League via Metallica's own B-side treatment of So What inspired a resurrection of the band, who went on to tour and perform with the likes of Motorhead, Sham 69, Angelic Upstarts, and UK Subs. In this wide-ranging conversation, Animal tells me about his beginnings as an outlaw biker, discovering the punk scene, getting thrown off of Britain's hit TV show Top of the Pops for hiding an axe in his leather jacket, performing with Metallica in 1992 and again at the 30th anniversary shows in San Francisco, the origin of the lyrics to So What, raising a family, his upcoming autobiography, and the forthcoming Anti-Nowhere League documentary film. Before we get into that, in case you've never heard the original version, here it is in full, the Anti-Nowhere League with So What.
So fucking what?
So here it is, my conversation with Animal of Anti-Nowhere League. This is Speak and Destroy. I feel like so many of us, if it wasn't for this kind of music, it's like jails, institution, or death were the other choices.
Absolutely. But it is. Only the guys who are involved with it know that it did save us from alternative lifestyles. So I'm always one for helping now on the up and coming music scene in my local town because I know it did me a lot of good. So I think I did good anyway, Ryan. I think at the end of the day, I'm still alive and people still like me, so meaning my family.
I just was refreshing my memory this morning on the Rolling Stones recap of the Metallica 30th anniversary shows. That Rolling Stone took special notice of you, and of all the myriad of guests that were there that night that you performed, they put you at the top of the most exciting and the guy who towered over everyone.
Obviously the guy was obviously drunk, wasn't he? It was a good night because obviously the second time I've been on stage with them, and we had to go along obviously the sound check and stuff, so it was I won't say I was used to it, but obviously the first time when we did it, when I did it back in 92, it was a little bit of an eye-opener. You know, obviously being a small-time punk band, suddenly jumping on stage at Wembley, with 10,000 punters standing there looking at me.
This one here is the B-side of the Unforgiven thing. Gonna have to invite someone up here to do some singing for us from Anti Nowhere League. His name is Animal, and I think the song is something like "So Fucking What."
Yo, how you doing, all right? It's a little number they just fucked up from us, and they ain't fucking paid me yet, all right? Most I'll get out of this song, all right? It's called "So Fucking What."
It was a little bit hairy, but this time was it didn't matter so much now. Well, fuck it, you know. I've already passed the point of no return. I thought, well, fuck it, it doesn't matter, you know. So it was, it was more fun, should we say, the second time around than it was, the first time. I think I shit myself the first time, but the second time was party time, so it was easier.
We from the UK and the Empty Nowhere League salute ya! But so fucking what?!
As you're putting together this documentary, have you done the sit-down interviews for that yet, or is that still coming?
I've done a few. They've done live stuff, and obviously people were around me, people involved with it. I was hoping that Lars was going to be involved. I haven't spoke to the people who are filming it at the moment, but I know that they had an appointment with Lars. But they've been out in California. They interview with Stuart Copeland and I think guys from Rancid and stuff. So they've been talking to a lot of people, and I haven't had a catch up lately who has done what. But I think there's quite a few people involved in this documentary, which is it's a bit of an eye opener for me because over the years I didn't realise. You know, although I went out to say, I hope people, you don't realise how many people you pick up along the way who actually you quite like. So when you sit down and you have them all come back to you and you think, fuck, you know, So I'm a little bit in the dark with it, but I think it's going to be quite exciting. I think it's going to be a different angle. So I'm good. And also my book is going to be out about the same sort of time, I think, which, believe it or not, comes from, I've actually taken the route of when I went on with Metallica in 92, and until I went back with their party 30 years later, on their 30th birthday. My book evolves around that period, but it goes back to how I grew up, blah, blah, and all the trouble I got into, etc. But I've used that as sort of like the backbone part of it, which is, you know, reason why I'm on stage, I suppose, you know, because obviously after 92, it was those guys who sort of didn't talk me into it, but sort of said, why isn't the band still going? Why aren't you doing it? Why don't you get back on stage? Why don't you? So it was a you know, a kick up the arse for me to get back together with the band in 92. So quite an important time that was for me, because otherwise I would have just fucked off and that was it. I think I would have been, because obviously I was in a building trade, etc. But I don't think I would have went back to music in 92, if they hadn't given me a nudge. I think, I was, obviously hadn't been on stage for quite a few years, and I was in the building trade, and I was back with my mates and stuff, and I sort of buried the band. But it was good that they, you know, gave me a kick up the arse, really, because I really enjoy the band now. That's what I'm saying. You know, I think early in the mid-80s, to late 80s, it was pretty dull, the punk rock scene for us in the UK. It was, you know, it was like all dressed up, nowhere to go. So, you know, pretty much bored with it all. But obviously, the resurgence in the 90s, it started coming back into being exciting again, that I was glad I was on board with that. So, you know, I owe it to the boys.
I love it. Well, and I didn't realize, you know, with the documentary and with the book, the serendipity that I happen to come calling right now. That's a nice convergence of events. Yeah.
It will be. I think, if all goes to plan, I mean, obviously you don't know, it's all down to the editing, as we know, and everything else. But I'm excited the fact that the story is going to be told, you know, the truth, the whole truth. So I think it's going to be an eye opener. And I think if people liked me before, they won't like me now. No, I don't know. They'll find it interesting. But did you, obviously going back to the 30th party, it was a good time for me, because obviously when they invited me over for the 30th, they invited me and my wife over, and said, come over and join the party and stuff. But it was a bit of an eye-opener, because, back in 1990, I hadn't really heard of Metallica. Obviously, it was still pretty fresh in the UK. And obviously, everybody said, oh, you they've covered So What, and, you know, you should be pleased, big metal band. But I obviously didn't know that much about them. So obviously, when I went back in to do the 30th party, I've learnt a lot more about myself. And I did like the guys. I did, you know. I mean, they looked after me, loved it. And you know, I went to dinner with them and that. And you know, nice bunch of blokes. And, you know, I'm not going to say I've got a favourite, but I have got a couple of favourites. But so they looked after an old punk band. So it was good. But obviously, when I went back in for the 30th party, it was very interesting, because they obviously paid for the flight for me and the missus. And we got on board the plane, and it's the first time in my whole life that I'd ever turned left on an aeroplane. Are you with me?
It took me a second,
because usually,
but yes.
Turn right is where all the shitty seats are, right down the end. I'm usually rammed. See, I'm about 6'3", so I'm usually down in a seat near the toilet or something with my fucking legs stuck up around my ears, you know, and it really is a dog shit for me to fly. But to actually walk onto that plane, and the stewardess is direct your left, it was like, wow. It was, it was business class. This was, I could put my fucking legs out. It was great, you know. And they did look after us, because obviously when we got into, into San Francisco, they looked after us all the time, me and my wife. So they did that. It always astounded me, really. They didn't need to be so generous. and be about me and my wife's well-being. It was really it quite touching, really. When you've had a lot of shit thrown at you in the past, all of a sudden a couple of genuine things like that, it makes a lot of difference. So yes, without getting all slushy on you, it was quite an eye opener for me that they actually looked after us so well. And when we went along, obviously had to sound check with the guys, and I went up there with them, obviously had a little chat with them and everything, and did a sound check, which is quite easy enough because it's not rocket science, as we know. So what? It's not. It doesn't take months of preparation, that song, which is the beauty of it. But and then afterwards, James just sort of said to me, "Do you want to come on and sing one of Metallica's songs with us?" I said, "Yeah, sure, no problem." And he said, "Well, you come up and do sing Destroy." So I said, "Yeah, no problem. That's good." So I went off stage, and my wife said, "What did you just say to James?" I said, "What did he just ask?" I said, "He just asked me to come up and sing one of their songs." She said, "What song is that?" And I said, "Well, I think it's called Sing Destroy." I said, "Never heard it." This is true. This is honest true. And then, she said, "Oh, for fuck's sake." She said, "You're going to stand up in front of thousands of people and sing with Metallica, a song you've never heard before." I said, "It'll be all right." I said, I'll make it up. I said, "That's punk, isn't it? I'll make it up as I go along. It's all right." She went, "Oh, Christ, that's it." She said, "That's it. You're taking the mickey out of me. I was going to actually stand up there like a right fucking knob end, you know." So anyway, we went back to the hotel. Their driver took us back to the hotel. And a guy came up in the hotel with a little present. And it had, said to Sophie, my wife. And he came out and said, "Oh, Sophie." And she said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, nobody knows we're here." But so I said, "Well, take it up to the hotel room." But he took it up there and opened it up. And there's some flowers and all that for Sophie and saying, "Thank you for coming over," and blah, blah. And there was a laptop in there, laptop computer in there, in the basket. So we immediately went straight on and found the lyrics to Seek and Destroy. And
wow.
I don't think Metallica knew that. I don't think they knew that because obviously I was going to make the words up, but I went on with them. That's what you do in punk, you make it up. But I actually went pre-armed because of the computer they gave my wife as a present, and which saved the day, I think, and they didn't probably realize that.
It would have been great if you would have turned the computer on and the lyrics were the first thing you saw.
It would have been fantastically easy, but no, we had to scout around for them. But it was a real eye opener because it was I've never seen so much generosity, really. And I think they and I've seen them a few times and met up with them a few times at different shows and that, and they've always treated me really, really, really well. And in this day and age where I made so many enemies out in the music business, it's refreshing that, some rockers actually understand where you're coming from.
And to think about the scale of those shows, I mean, for people who may not be familiar, they played 77 songs over 4 shows. And each day had a 3 or 4 hour sound check, and then there was a day off where they spent 8 hours rehearsing. And then just the number, I don't even know how many guests, but just the sheer number of guests. And to think that, the mechanics of that organization, the way that, for it to run, to think about what they did for you and then to extrapolate that and magnify it with all the other people they had there. It's quite an undertaking. Yeah.
Yeah, and also they did party afterwards. I mean, they didn't sort of waft in and waft out like, some of the artists who were there on the day, hands up against the paparazzi and all this bollocks, which I'm really not into. But they were genuinely there with us, in with us afterwards, drinking that. And I think, gosh, that was a pretty much of a pretty good route march for those duration of the time they had to be involved to get that show together. They have good people working with them, so wonderful people I met up with, who organized all the things of that. And obviously they would do, wouldn't they? I mean, this is it, it's not expected that people are going to turn up drunk and fuck up. Hats off to them. Toby, they admirable guys, and I I'm glad I can call them pals. I really am. But
let's go back and then go forward. You mentioned, you know, motorcycles, and I know that that's come up in different interviews that I've seen with you over the years. You know, getting into a bit of trouble in the younger days. What can you tell me a little bit about that? That sort of culture that you came up in as a youth.
Yeah, I think without boring the tits off of everybody. I thought I'm a council estate. You know, when the skinheads came in about 67, so I was a young sort of skinhead whelp, 11-year-old whelp coming up in the estate, and he was had to be in the skinhead scene because it was safety numbers. You know, that was it. If you were on a skinhead, your life was pretty fucking miserable. So. And I had a lot of Jamaican mates who taught me into, you know, all about the reggae scene and stuff, which was all very lovely. And I still got my friends now, which I see. But deep down, I was always, you know, I think my sisters, my older sisters were rocker girls. So always a lot of rockers around our house, although I was a little skinhead whelp. But the love for motorcycles was from an early age. And yeah, as I got to an age of starting to be able to ride motorcycles, I started getting into motorcycles, started getting into the rock scene, and hand in hand with a load of trouble. But as I morphed from different gangs of motorbike guys, so trouble followed you. And I think without making such a big deal of it caught me up. And I had to do a little bit for Her Majesty. But I think after that, I mean, obviously hanging out with the sort of heavyweight, motorcycle clubs, I think my destiny was something that I was a little bit concerned about. I knew that I didn't want to die, and I knew that I didn't want to end up, you know, doing years in prison and stuff. As we know, you know, many roads to take in life, and I wasn't quite sure. I was a bit confused of where I was wanted to go, and I went to live in Canada for a bit. I went up and I was told I got to get lost for a little while because things were a bit heated, so I went to Canada. I lived in the Rocky Mountains. Well, I was in Canada probably, I think it was about 10 months. I like to say a year, but I think it was about 10 months by the time I got my act together and came back again.
And what year was this?
This was 79.
Okay. Wow. So, yeah. So punk, as we tend to think of punk, of course, is, you know, 77. What was sort of your experience with punk as it began and kind
it
of
never really,
as you got
it
into
never
it?
Really, never really crossed my path in the early days. You know, we were all motorcycles, and there was a lot more important things with different, there were a lot of clubs running around, Sabre rattling, and there was a lot more involvement with the motorcycle scene than there is nowadays, I think. Yeah. And our path never really crossed. I never really... music wasn't, a fore thing for me. I wasn't really musically. I used to throw my head about, at dances or parties, getting drunk, to Black Sabbath and all the other, most of us did, or Meatloaf or something. But it was, that's all it was for me, just, time to get drunk. But it was only when I came back from Canada in 79 that in the clubhouse, in the bike club I was with, they had just obviously recharged all the jukebox with, Clash, Stranglers. It was a bit of a revelation for me. I suddenly realised that, wow, this was really exciting. And I think at that point I was in two minds what to do when I came back. I was a bit lost, although these guys welcomed me back, open arms, all was good, and they gave me another bike and things were okay. I knew that something had changed in me. Living in the Rocky Mountains does change you. Right. It was, it was time to just sit back and think about things, I think. I spent a few months in the Rockies living in a little log cabin with a girl, and it was time to reevaluate the situation where I wanted to head out in life. And then obviously hearing the jukebox go back, I thought, wow. And then met up with Magoo, who was an old biker mate, who was a guitarist, and then we started strumming songs together. You know, we had a great sense of humour over it, and then I found it very easy to write songs, and I found it very easy to perform on stage without getting into trouble, if you know what I mean. I could get up there and I could shout and scream and tell everyone to go fuck themselves and all that, and the coppers wouldn't nick me. And it was like, it was good therapy. And I do feel that, you know, I learned a lot through the past, but I do feel that it punk saved me. And it was quite interesting. I didn't join a punk band for sex, drugs, and rock and roll, because I had that anyway. I joined it for my own mentality, my own stability. And this is what I found the most rewarding from it, that I could beat myself up for a couple of hours on stage go and do it the next night without ending up, you know, behind bars. It's always been...
Without having to disappear like into the mountains in another country for a year.
Well, I think those days were very easy back then, because you didn't need things like visas and stuff. They'd just stand on the border and sort of say, yeah, how much money you got? And I go, a few hundred, and I've got to go and see relatives. All right, then fuck off, in you come. It was very easy. You know, it's difficult now, isn't it, to move about anywhere, as we know. But, life was pretty easy with that way. And I think... because I used to travel a lot with a motorcycle club anyway. We used to travel all around Europe and stuff on the bikes, and we was always out on runs everywhere. But actually, the band was like another arm from it, really. It was a bit like Traveling Gypsy, you know, Traveling Circus, and, you know, have bag, we'll travel, and off we went, the same like we did on the bike club, you know. So it seemed the right move to actually morph into it. And the guys obviously were a little bit against me leaving, obviously, and saying that, you know, they got to remove my tattoos with a broken bottle or whatever they decided they weren't going to do. But they just said, as long as I date them, I'd be allowed to leave amicably, leave my bike and date my tattoos. And job done. And I was allowed to leave. So, and then obviously the punk scene was quite important to me. It suddenly absorbed everything I could do. I enjoyed songwriting. I enjoyed, traveling. I enjoyed the whole scene, but I didn't do it, like I say, for any kind of adoration. I didn't need, and I didn't want, any type of rock star adoration in it at all, because I'd just come from all that and I didn't want that. I just wanted people to dislike me at the time. I'm at that age now. I don't feel the same problem, obviously. But,
Did any of those guys, your old brothers from the old club, did they come around at some point and kind of realize, like, oh, wait, he's actually gotten himself into something pretty cool. This is, you know... We can come to these gigs.
Played a few of their parties, obviously, and a lot of bike club parties. A lot of American GIs were stationed in, bikers were stationed in the UK. So we used to go around the GI place, and a lot of Americans, stationed there, motorbike boys, different clubs and stuff. Although we were a punk band, we still entertained a lot of bikers in the early days. And I still see them now. I still ride, obviously. I've got my Harley, and I still ride down. If they've got a party on, if I'm not away, I'll go down and have a few beers with them. I am lucky. I can actually, cherry pick a little bit. I can be a bit like a butterfly. I can flit in and out of places without having any ties, really. So I think I got both sides of the coin. I think I got the best sides of everything. So, and yeah, I'm still pals with them, and I'm still pals with a lot of the bike clubs. And as long as I don't open my mouth too much about what they get up to, I'm safe.
Indeed. Indeed.
That's it. I learned the rules a long time ago, mate.
Yeah, I don't ride myself, but I do. I have a couple of good friends who are in clubs here in America, and I know what you mean. It's you can hang around and be cool and social. There's just certain subjects that you avoid in conversation.
Well, I always used to say very easy. I mean, the punks, you know, they understand me now because they know that I've always rode motorcycles and stuff, and they've accepted me. You know, and that's always been the case. But I always learned the ground rules from the bike clubs, and then the simple thing was the rules were very simple. You know, if you had a bad mouth, someone would shut it for you, and believe me, somebody's bigger than you all the time. So it was quite easy, you know, it's funny because as I left the club, it was like I don't know, like venturing out into the real world again. It was like, you know, the rules had all changed. So we try to bring a little bit of that into the band, and we still do, you know, respect each other and don't diss each other and, you know, look after each other all the time. You know, a little bit close. We always have been in the band. And I think when the times get tough is when you show your true colours, and that's it. We seem to thrive on that's why I think we're still going as a small band, because it is it's difficult. Difficult to stay on the road in a band, you know, especially a smaller punk band like us. You know, you still got to get in the van, you still got to travel, you still got to, you know, it's getting more difficult. So the most important ingredient is you're looking after each other, and it's we've always done that. We've always know how far to push each other, know when to shut up, and that's the most important thing. So it's still enjoyable. Still, you know, very, very enjoyable now.
So what happened in there? You know, you mentioned kind of the late 80s and early 90s, like skipping up to there. As the band sort of wound down for a period, you know, and you mentioned, getting into other things sort of professionally and to make a living and that sort of thing. What was that transition like for you, and where did you find yourself kind of in the quote unquote real world, you know, having been in the biker culture for so long and then the punk music culture for so long, and then all of a sudden you're, you know.
Yeah, but the thing is, I mean, even with the bikes, you still have to earn money. You know, it's not all drug dealing and, you know, debauchery. You have to earn money. So I was I was a mechanic in a bike shop for a little while, but my old man was a builder, so I morphed into the building trade with him. So it fitted in well with traveling when I was with either the bike club. I could actually come and go as I wanted on the building sites, and also with the band. You know, we never had money in the band to actually look at in your hand and say, well, I'm going to go and buy myself a motorbike. I mean, if you wanted a bike, you had to go and work for it. And that was it. So the band was one thing. You know, as we all know, record companies ripping everybody off, and same old story, isn't it? You know, it's not unusual to, because we're only a small punk band. You know, we might be established now, but as in finances, you know, if you want money for extras, you earn it. And the building trade, most of us worked in the band and always have done. So when we down tools in the, I say mid, we were all bored in the mid 80s, and we really down tools sort of late 80s. Getting towards probably about 88, I think we sort of down tools, and then went into the building trade full time, and that was it. It was a good time to earn money in the building trade. There was, we used to buy properties and do them up, and a whole gang of blokes working with us. It was like being on tour again. Load of plumbers, electricians, and all that. We'd all get in the van and bug off and build houses. So you know, earn money, and it was quite an easy transition. Coming back to the music scene was a bit more difficult because, you know, as my wife, because I'd married then, and my wife said, you know, you don't earn fuck all in the music business. You know, you're down to all in, you know, from a building firm where you, you know. But I'd built our house we live in, and we were pretty much, stable with our finances. So it enabled me to creep back into the music scene doing the odd show. I only do the music now full time because I don't need to do any building work. I'm pretty much safe on that now. But I think the early days I had to tread a bit carefully, because I've got three kids, and I did have obviously responsibilities of looking after them, make sure they were fed. And then when the recession kicked in, we had a bad recession over here, and building trade went tits up, and music was very bad in the early 90s, trying to get gigs and stuff. I had to go back to my old way. I had to go and work on nightclub doors, get me head kicked in for 50 quid a night. That was most unpleasant. I had to feed the kids, and that was it. So, you know, and the building trade was a bit over a lull. Like I say, the recession was kicked in, and interest rates were shit, and building trade was going down the pan. So, back to the old ways of standing on nightclub doors and fighting gypsies, which is most unpleasant. not a way to earn a living, Ryan, I tell you. I had to come home in the evenings, my eye done in, and my broken nose and fingers and everything, and the wife would say, "You're right tonight." I go, "No, not tonight." I'm suffering tonight. So it was, but I mean, that was it really. So it was.
There's the old saying, "Well, it beats digging ditches," but I think in this case with this job, it doesn't. It doesn't beat digging ditches. I think digging ditches would be better.
Winston, our bass player, would say we used to work on the doors in the early day of the band. Because obviously no money in the band, so you know we used to bump tiles up on our heads and out on rooftops for building companies or working for the old man humping gear around, or and in the evenings working on the doors. So it was something we were quite used to. You know, it's funny to look back at it now, but obviously you have a picture of a bouncer now. He's a bald bloke. He's a fucking great big bloke, and he's you know, he stands there and he don't say anything. Maybe, you know, but in the old days, all the bouncers had, you didn't have any training. It's just if you had a reputation in the town, that's what you did for your money. You know, so there was always some fucker wanted to prove that your reputation wasn't that good. you had to earn your money. But it was easier back then because, you know, you'd stand on the door, hope you didn't get too much of a beating, and then get some money at the end of it. So, you know, another part of paying the bills, really. So punk rock bands are not all rock and roll to riches, you know.
In fact,
that's why we appreciate Metallica, you see, throwing out a few, inviting me in for a meal. So, oh, Governor, God, I haven't eaten for a month, Governor. they looked after us.
And in those early days, you know, and I'm skipping backwards a little bit, but in the early 80s, I know you guys played with, you know, The Exploited, The Damned, The UK Subs. I mean, you were Anti Nowhere League was definitely right there in the mix with a lot of bands that, you know, none of you were probably aware at the time in any of your bands how influential all of your bands would become. But you know, I think it's easier to romanticize from across the pond, so to speak, and think about how cool must have been.
Yeah, but it's now, because all the names you just mentioned, and we still play in the UK. We have the Rebellion festivals and that. All the same bands are all on it still. We all do it now because we enjoy it. You know, in the old days, a lot more fisticuffs, obviously, and a lot more hassles, a lot more grief. But nowadays, it's party. So it's quite nice to meet the old guys. You know, we talk about our families and our motorbikes now, and then, you know, it seems like it's the reward we've got for hanging on in there. And I think we've all got our own stories to tell. And I think the Anti-Nowhere League, when the documentary comes out, will be quite an unusual angle, I think. I think it will be. But obviously, I say, I'm hoping anyway. I know they filmed so much footage that, you know, they've been filming for nearly a year now. You know, so there's a fucking lot of footage out there. So I'm hoping that, they're going to find a lot to have than not just sea full of shite, if you know what I mean. You know? But I think it's going to be all right. I'm confident. Yeah.
Now, I think a lot of people, you know, of course, Anti Nowhere League is very well known for So What, but I think people who aren't that familiar with the history of the band may not realize that was actually a B-side to your first single, and that your first single was actually in the top 50 in the UK singles chart. for yeah. you know a month or so. What can you tell me a little bit about that? And then, of course, the you know, the controversy that swelled over the B-side. I mean, people have to remember in, you know, man, the late 70s and early 80s especially. I mean, this was even before the PMRC and advisory warnings on records
Absolutely.
And things. I mean, you couldn't.
Absolutely.
It was so much, you know, the Sex Pistols going on a talk show and cursing was like a cultural apocalypse.
They are punk rockers. The new craze, they tell me. They're heroes, not the nice, clean Rolling Stones.
No one even heard that one because he was drunk himself and he wasn't paying attention. When he asked, well, what do you do with the money? And I said, we fucking spent it.
Well, tell me more about it.
We fucking spent it, didn't we?
I don't know, have you?
Yeah, it's all gone.
Really?
Down the boozer.
40, really? Good Lord.
And rotten, he slipped up and said shit under his breath.
It's what?
Nothing, a rude word. Next question.
No. What was the rude word?
Shit.
Was it really? Good heavens, you frightened me to death.
Oh, all right.
What about you girls behind?
Right, you're dead, isn't he, this gamer?
Are you,
Well, your granddad.
Are you worried or are you just enjoying yourself?
Enjoying myself.
Are you?
Yeah.
That's what I thought you were doing.
I always wanted to meet you.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Susie, she was just being, like, coy with him. And he said, oh, maybe we'll meet after.
We'll meet after, shall we?
You dirty son. You dirty old man.
Steve completely understood that he was talking to a drunk, as you would a drunk in a pub, and he just topped him.
Well, keep going, Chief, keep going. Go on, you've got another 5 seconds. Say something outrageous.
You dirty bastard.
I just remember this fucking cunt just started provoking us and we coated him off.
Go on, again.
You dirty fucker.
What a clever boy.
What a fucking rotter.
Well, that's it for tonight.
You know, like people today don't quite understand like how insane it was to put out a song like that.
Because we came in with the 80s and 81 was when that was released. It was sort of like the backlash of the Pistols, I feel. It was like, because they had all sort of finished off and everything. And we thought, hang on a minute, we're all dressed up. We want to do this. So it came back with a vengeance, like GBH exploited and all that. It came back with a really nasty edge to it. And I think we as the Anti-Noah League, always found it a little bit funny. You know, we always had a little bit of humour in it, in the side of it. It's, you know, fuck you, but ha-ha. It always had that little bit of element to it. And I think when we came and released Streets of London, really that was a little bit humorous. It was a little bit. They tried to say we was against. They always try to pin a label on whatever we were doing. But obviously, at the time, they thought we were against all the military and stuff. You know, and it was all bollocks what they were writing. So the flip side was just a literally, well, fuck you. And it really was. It was a song which was written by McGoo and I within minutes of sitting in a pub before we were about to go up to record the Streets of London, and listening to this conversation. And it was a conversation of a couple of fucking twats in a bar. You know, I've done this and I've done that. I've done, you know, and as one spoke, the other one wasn't listening, but just trying to outdo him. We were sitting there and listening to this conversation and the other one was going, yeah. Anyway, I've done that. And the other, yeah. It was my fucking dullest conversation. I said to my goo, fuck me, that's dull, isn't it? And he said, so fucking what? And it really was literally bang, bang, bang. The most stupidest things we could think of, you know. I'll fuck this and I'll fuck that. So fucking what, you know. Because this conversation was getting more stupid and stupid. So we wanted the song to be the most fucking stupidest song. And two fingers up on the flip side of Ralph McTell. But we didn't realise, you know, that it was going to cause so much controversy for the record company, because you don't, you know, you think, oh, you're going to do it and it'll be fun, you know, fuck them, fucking it's fun. But obviously, financially wise, the record company lost a load of money, load of trouble, load of hassle over it. And obviously that's when we were putting out the We Are The League album, so we had to keep redoing the lyrics of that. If they wouldn't print it, none of the print presses would print all any of our records after that. And then we were meant to go up to Top of the Pops and play that, and then they kicked us off of there because I, well, That's another story. But they did want, they said they had allowed the Anti-Noah League to go on to Top of the Pops, providing I didn't bring an axe with me. I mean, I know it's an old story now, and everybody knows this story, who knows the Anti-Noah League. But, I mean, that was a red rag to the bull. I thought, there's no fucking way I'm going to go out there. Yes, sir, no, sir, I won't bring me axe, sir. So I stuck the axe up my jacket. See, and I had it inside my leather jacket because we walked in there, and then, you know, it's only realised when we got through actually into the BBC buildings that I was carrying this axe. Of course, they all shit themselves then and said, "Fuck me, he's got that axe," and you know, and obviously locked us into our dressing room and wouldn't let us out. And it was it's all in the documentary about how we nearly got in a fight with those bands up there and all that, and they would try to throw us out of the building. They fog marched us out of the building, and anyway.
Well, you know what's so great about that is there's a nice through line from you and the axe in the leather jacket on Top of the Pops to in the 90s, kind of the peak of Metallica at, some would argue, their most commercial, you know, after they'd cut their hair and so on. And they went on to, I think it was the MTV Europe Awards, and they were supposed to play their new single. And unbeknownst to everyone at MTV, they launched into So What instead.
Metallica!
And I think that they
really is two fingers up, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's Anti-Nowhere League on Top of the Pops, right? You know,
yeah.
15 years later.
Mate, it never ceases to amaze me that, you know, I mean, over the years, so many young bands, it's a bit like the song has become a bit like, you know, when a guitarist starts playing, he plays the old riff, doing bum, 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 Smoke on the Water, bum, 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 it's a bit like it, when the punk is da, 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 you know, they actually cannot stop themselves, and it's a lovely, I get weekly things with young bands saying, do you mind if we record it? Do you mind if we record it? You know, I say, good luck to you, mate. You know, the only thing is it'll stamp your old card and you won't get fuck all in life. but they get such a... And I've always said this with the Anti, you know, and even Metallica, I think Lars was saying to me that, you know, they were in the audience when we played in 1980 in LA somewhere. I think even James, I think we were in the audience, and they were looking up, you know, and then me throwing myself about on the face, telling everyone to fuck off. And like, you don't realise that these people, and I say these people, but a lot of people, and myself included, you know, you look at a band who's, I will say, you know, raw, untalented rawness, you know, it's like a letting a bull out of into a ball ring. You don't know what's going to happen. You really don't. So, you open the door and you open this fucking raging bull, out it comes, and you wait to see what happens. And it's a bit like that with the Anti-Noah League. You're not quite sure what's going to happen. You know, the equipment can fuck up, everything can fuck up, the fight can start, everyone can say, you can start kicking off, and you know, and everyone, it's more inspirational, I feel, for bands saying, I can do that, I can, then they're going to watch Genesis, or, you know, it's a lot more in your face, and it's like, fuck, I can do that. And I think more people come along to a band like the Anti-Noah League and start a band than they do ever going to watch, you know, Coldplay or anything, you know, which is happening. I don't think you go along to Coldplay, sing along to it and say, I'm going to start a band. I just don't think it happens, do you? It just don't happen.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty chuffed that, you know, we inspired a lot of people who rightly, and probably do, as we know with Metallica, go up and do it better. But it's still the rawness of that charging bull is still at an Anti-Noah League concert. And it is, it always will be until I'm dead. And it's as simple as that. I look at every show I go into just like, I'm going into the ring. And that's it. I'm just, you know, you pet me down and off I go. You know, you wind me up and then I go. And, you know, and that's it. And, you know, I don't know where I am a quarter of an hour after the show. I don't even know who I am. You know, it's like, it's a crazy experience. And I think this is what gave us longevity, I think. On the underground world of punk, is that we still get into a small venue and put blood, sweat, and snot on the ceiling.
It's crazy to think about, you know, how much we celebrate individual liberty and free speech and so on in Western countries, and particularly the UK and the United States, and then to imagine that in 1981 there was still something, you know, there was a police squad called the Obscene, you know, what was it, Obscene Publication Squad or something like that. And like the idea that was something that the cops actually did is just.
Well, yeah. The only thing is, I find now though, Ryan, is which I find, you know, it's a bit. Always upsetting to me because at the end of the day, I'm still at that age. I think, oh, fuck it, you don't like me? Yeah, fuck it, I don't care anyway. I never have done. But it is a little bit because of the keyboard warriors nowadays that they can beat me with a stick of a song I wrote many, many years ago, and they can beat me with that stick now. If I wrote a song years ago about something, you should keep it in that period. You know, and if you like the song, it belongs in that period. It's not like, I said something. Well, I said a lot of things in 1980, you know. But if you start hitting me with that stick now, as I'm an elderly gentleman, you know, you can't hit me with that stick. You know, you can hit me with a stick of the lyrics like right now, but you can't hit me with those. And I find that a little bit, you know, I think, well, fuck me, mate. If you was back in the 80s, you would fucking understand what it was about. But you get some young fucking kid 18 against it. Well, if they don't like me, they don't like me. But when they use a handle, you know, they use a handle of something I've said back in 1980, I find that a little bit, I feel like, you know, oh, fuck you, you know. If I ever see you on the fucking street, mate, I'll fucking...
I don't do that. And those are the people you will never see on the street. they wouldn't know how to even find the street. Yeah.
But I still like the punk rebellion shows. I still like the sort of festivals as well as the small shows. So you know, to me, punk is ripe and doing well. I just think people know that when bands like us have cast off our mortal coil, there won't be others. There won't be others.
Yes.
Because everybody is so controlled now, and they can't say, they can't do, they can't be, they can't, you know. And if you get a bleating out of most people, all they want to be is a rock star. They just want to be a rock star, you know. They got no idea of how to fucking tread the boards up in Newcastle or fucking Glasgow, getting your head kicked in or by like fucking mad Scottish people or something. They got no idea. So, you know, I think those days are going to be gone when it's, when we're gone. So we'll be, you know, in your face music. That's what I think.
I absolutely agree. You couldn't have articulated that better, my friend. It's so true. And I think that there's something that, like a lot of comedians will say, there's nothing less funny than a joke that has to be explained. Yeah. And I think, to parse through, not just the Anti-Nowhere League, but a lot of bands of the era and a lot of bands of that spirit, and to try to hold it to a standard outside of that context, it's nonsense. It's the same as, look, we celebrate in our culture today, a lot of us, NWA, for example. There was a big movie about NWA, and Ice Cube, you know, stars in family comedies. And he was writing some of the most aggressively homophobic and misogynist and violent lyrics, and we're able to look at that and contextualize it and say, well, here's all of the extenuating circumstances around it, and kind of take it for what it is, right or wrong, for better or worse. And I don't know why we couldn't apply that same set of that same lens to punk and to all sorts of art. It's art. At the end of the day, it's expression.
That's exactly it. You know, when you start analysing lyrics out of context of time and stuff, then obviously it's those days are gone. I often say to people, I'm just a fucking dinosaur. I'll be fucking dead and gone soon. Nobody give a fuck anyway, so it won't matter. You know, but it's a shame that. Well, not a shame, because that's the wrong word to say, because people come along to our show. We get a whole lot of new people come along all the time. They're not all just old people who come along just for nostalgia. We get a whole new people who just still understand what rock is blood, sweat, and snot, you know. And it's the old saying, the devil's got the best music. I said, we know, you know, it comes from the gut, the best music. So it's still turning a few people on. But I think, like I said earlier, when that reason has gone, I think people now are so other bands. I up and coming bands. They're so obsessed with of how they look, how they be. There's no real guts in there. There's a frame without any guts inside it. And it's a bit of a shame because the young kids say, "What do you think? What advice do you give me? What advice is it? Fucking grow a pair, mate, and get out there fucking threaten somebody."
Yeah, right. I mean, perfect. I mean, because you know, one of the things I think it was Ricky Gervais. I think it was an interview I saw with him where he was talking about a study, like a university study, you know, where they'd asked a bunch of students and a bunch of kids what they wanted to be when they grew up, and the number one answer was famous. And it used to at least be, you know, famous rock star, famous doctor, famous scientist. Yeah. Now it's just famous for its own sake. And yeah, that says a lot, like you said, about there's no insides to that skeleton.
I don't, in a funny way, how old are you, Ryan? What age are you?
44. So I was,
okay.
So when you were on stage in Wembley, I was a senior in high school and, getting into trouble myself and listening to Metallica all the time.
But I think you will appreciate that, you know, this is an end of an era. You've seen the beginning and you will see the end of this.
I mean, look, my you know, I'm very into metal and punk and I'm very into comedy. And I can tell you one of the things that shaped me as a child when I was, you know, 10, 11 years old, MTV used to show reruns of The Young Ones on Saturday nights at two in the morning.
Vivian, this is my bedroom!
Oh, yeah?
Yes, I was here first!
You got any witnesses?
Look, I don't need witnesses. Just get off my property!
No!
Get out!
Look, this must be my bedroom. All my clothes are here.
No, they're not, Vivian. All right, then have the bedroom.
I don't want it. It's not mine.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
You said it was yours just now.
So did you?
No, I didn't.
Didn't.
Neil, your bedroom's on fire.
This was my bedroom. Oh, no.
My brother and I would either stay up late for it or we would videotape it. And I used to watch videotapes of Young Ones episodes. This, you got to imagine this is a kid in Indiana in the early 80s. Yeah. And seeing Motorhead and Madness and just the characters and the humor. And yeah, so I mean, I feel very lucky and very blessed, honestly, to have.
She's funny. You know. There again, there's another show. They couldn't make that nowadays,
right? Because it's
politically incorrect, isn't it? So it's like you've seen the end of something else again. You know, it's you'll only see us on the reruns, as they say.
Indeed.
Or was it Arnie who said that on one of his films? You'll only see me on. I'll be back. And that you'll only see me on the reruns.
Yeah,
that's it, mate.
Killian. I'll be back. Only in a rerun.
And isn't it? I mean, you mentioned you have three kids. I've got two. What ages are your kids now?
Well, this is another little story. My oldest daughter, 28, she's been married. She works for the BBC. It's another little story because I had to take her along to the BBC for her interview. And she said, "Oh, Dad, will you come in?" You know, and I went, "No, I'll wait outside," because last time I went in there, I was frog marched out of the building carrying an axe. She said, "They won't remember that." I said, "Yeah, but just imagine if I walked in there with you and somebody come out, 'Oh, you, I chucked you out 30 years ago. Go on, sod off,' you know." I said, "You wouldn't get the job, would you?" So she got the job, obviously, in research in the BBC. And she married a presenter, one of the BBC presenters. And I am now a grandfather, which is lovely. I've watched, you know, his career grow more and more. And I've obviously kept a quiet profile myself because I didn't want to diss anything him or my daughter were doing in the BBC. So I just watched them. So, yes, mate, I have to be a bit careful because the old man's reputation sometimes precedes him and, you know, it can be a bit it was very easy when my, cause and I've also got another daughter, 26, and my son's 24. So, but it was very easy with my daughters when they were younger, of any, should we say, up and coming boyfriends. They were a little bit worried. They were a little bit concerned coming around my house. You know, they used to be very polite to me. Very, yes sir, no sir. Because I'd say, you fuck with my daughter, you mess my daughter up, you'll be. So they got quite used to standing there very politely in front of me. But it was, that's all, another part of the book. But me being a father, which was quite it's another thing for my therapy. I needed my family background was not that good as most people's wasn't many years ago. So to have a family was something I needed. And touch wood, it's been very good for me. They still allow me to ride my bike, and I'm still allowed to go out and punk bands. I'm still allowed to do things that they haven't changed. The old man is always known when I come in and out on the bike and stuff. And then, you know, I'm part of the furniture around here now.
I love it. And yeah, I can't wait to read the book, because I love the idea of, you know,
I did want to call it The Iron Butterfly, but they went off that because it was just the fact that it was the way I flitted from different things through my life, on the estate, I had a really bad lisp, and I couldn't pronounce my S's really badly. And of course, that was always a point for being bullied. So I didn't have a pleasant young upbringing in a way of being bullied, but so to join with the skinheads, and that was was a safety thing. But and then I was just hanging around with hard boys and just carried on doing that, and it was just something that I found it was easier for me to hang out with hard geezers than it was not so tough people. I don't really understand a lot of people, so I understand the bad sides.
Indeed.
I understand the wild side of life, should we say. Yeah.
I think a lot of us who are from broken families, you know, we come to understand that family is what you make it. You can make your own family, and whether that's in the, you know, being a skinhead in the late 60s, early 70s, or being in a bike club, or being in the punk rock scene, or on road crew with a band, or in the military, or wherever you find that that family until you can build it for yourself, you know.
You do learn from your parents. There's no doubt about it. And you can either follow them or you can reject them. So, you know, you learn. It's up to yourself to learn. But I went the other way. I'm lucky. My kids have turned out good. They've all got good jobs, all accountants and things. I'm married a school teacher. That's what you do, you see. You find somebody who's a school teacher. And then I can just fuck off on my bike and she does the teaching. So it worked out well. That was all right.
And that had to be great for the daughters to casually mention to the potential boyfriends when they say, "Oh, what's your dad carry around an axe or something?" And they go, "No, actually, he literally does."
Believe me, there's millions of funny stories here, especially when they had parties and stuff. But I won't bore you with all the details of that. But I think it was very healthy. I was a bit of a crazy guy, and it saved me talking too much to them. So it was quite easy.
Win-win in all situations. Well, listen, it's been so great talking to you. When can we expect the book? Do you have any idea, roughly?
I was talking to my manager the other day. See, I wanted to put it on ice for a bit because obviously a lot of legal things in there, and there's a lot of things I'm not, you know, the guys, you know, if I'm going to say the truth, whole truth, I don't want to upset you and bike clubs and mates of mine and stuff. So I wanted to sit on it for a little bit, but my manager seems to think I should put it out with a documentary because it is finished in July, August. So I'm just going to go right back over it again to just have a look and see whether I feel it's the right time or not. My daughter said, "Dad, give it to me, because, you know, when you're dead, I know what to do with it."
It's like the...
I don't know if I want to wait until I die before it comes out. But I think what it'll do is come out hand in hand with a documentary around about August. If I can just get my act together and just go through it again with a fine tooth comb to make sure that I'm not pissing off the wrong people, you know, and doing something stupid which I might regret. So, but I, you know, it is the truth, the whole truth again. So, you know, it's very hard to try and say the truth if you know, without saying the truth, isn't it? So it's going to be one of those things. I'll a couple of weeks' time, I know whether it's going to come out or not, but it will be out at some point before I'm in a nursing home.
Yeah, you don't want to do the Mark Twain. What was it where Mark Twain had the autobiography that was, what was it, 100 years after his death? he had some kind of legal contract that, you know, when it would be released.
I think with my book, though, Ryan, it's not whether I had the legal side, it's whether I end up with concrete boots or not. or popping up one of the motorways under London somewhere, which was what I don't want to do.
Indeed.
Did
you end up settling on a title after the Iron Butterfly?
I wanted to. There's many things, you know. My manager keeps saying it should be just Animal, but I wanted one the Iron Butterfly. I went through different things, and the other one was the We Don't Serve Your Kind Here. Because I was sold that so many times, going into pubs, going into places, we don't serve your kind here. I was used to it from an early age.
Yeah.
And it just seemed right to me. So I'm toying with that at the moment. But obviously, you know, the manager pushing for just Animal. Yeah. But I don't know.
I like that we don't serve your kind here, because it's sort of not a double entendre, but it has a lot of multiple meanings. You know, I mean, and it can be
absolutely.
It can be from going into pubs to being kicked off Top of the Pops to
it has
the lyrics
so many
and,
times.
Yeah.
Yeah, so many times, mate. I just feel I should have it tattooed on me somewhere.
It reminds me of what was Johnny Rotten's book, No Blacks, No Dogs, No Irish.
That's it.
And yeah, and people...
It does have that ring to it, doesn't it?
If you don't understand what it means, it's... But if you know, if that makes sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's what's great about it.
Well, you might have just twisted my arm a little bit more. So I think I should go back with the manager and just stake my case stronger than what his is. So we'll see. But,
perfect. Happy to be of
service. I will make a decision soon.
Happy to be of service. Okay. And I'll have to have you on again if you're up for it when the documentary's out and the book is out.
Fantastic. Yes, mate. Just give us a shout. That's no problem. You've got my email now. You've got my number. Thank you, Ryan. All right. And thanks for asking me to do it. And I'll talk to you soon.
My pleasure. You can check out the old school music video for So What on the Speak and Destroy YouTube channel. I've curated some great playlists, including a bunch of the original versions of songs Metallica has covered, including Anti Nowhere League, Diamond Head, Budgie, The Misfits, Nick Cave, Thin Lizzy, and more. I've used a combination of official music videos, killer live recordings, and straight studio offerings. There's also a playlist of Metallica doing a whole host of covers, including many that have never been released officially or on the record, like their version of TVI by The Stooges. It's easy to find, just look up Speak and Destroy on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or head over to speakanddestroy.com. While you're at it, please, if you haven't already, head over to iTunes or wherever you consume podcasts and leave us a 5-star rating and a nice little review. The more of these we get, the higher the visibility for the show and the more people can discover Speak and Destroy. Speak and Destroy is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network. Check out our past episodes with great guests like Rex Brown from Pantera, David Elvson of Megadeth, Lizzie Hale from Hailstorm, Rob Flynn of Machine Head, M. Shadows of Avenged Sevenfold, and many more, all talking about the greatest band in the world. Also check out my sister podcast, No Prize from God, which features conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. Speak and Destroy friendly guests who have appeared on there include Dwid Hellion from Integrity, Jesse Leach from Killswitch Engage, Matty Mullins of Memphis Mayfire, Blackie Lawless of Wasp, Max Cavalera of Soulfly, and many more. You can find me on Twitter at Ryan Downey and on Instagram at SuperheroHQ. As always, you guys have been great, and I've been Ryan J. Downey.